You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
This hour, we're going to be talking about cultural iconography and public memory, particularly after 1994, when we thought that public spaces and when it comes to memorializing history, rendering visible all peoples in the country in terms of who we are and where we come from, and the nascent democracy that we were trying to build after 1994, that would be reflected in everything from statues to the naming, to history, to syllabi, to what happens in our museums. And in fact, when it comes to cultural iconography and public memory, I think, but I'm not the expert, which is why I'm going to introduce one to you presently, that we haven't actually done very well, that it's been very exclusionary and very tardy as well. And so I asked Zahira Ashmal, founder and managing director of The City, to please, 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 pretty please, with a cherry on top, to share her excellence and thoughts on these issues with us on the show. And she's going to do exactly that from our Cape Talk studio. Hello, Zahira.
Good morning, Eusebius. How are you doing?
I'm good. How was the European summer?
Well, it was partly summer. Only the German part was hot. The Dutch part was a bit cold for my liking.
Nice. I was living vicariously through your social media updates about your journey and your playing and your learning and everything else. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And there's a whole lot more to come.
Absolutely. So here, I suppose the starting point here is to talk about 1994. So you have this, what the Constitution calls a radical break with the past, but we now know economically, in terms of the state, everything else in society, there was no radical break in 1994. There was a break, but not a radical break. When it comes to things like iconography and public memory, did we successfully have a radical break with the past and enter an era of far more inclusivity?
No, definitely not. I don't think so. Well, my work particularly focuses on the city, so I can make references to, well, my study at the moment is on Cape Town, that being the most visibly colonial city, and I can make references to certain points of iconography that we can talk about today.
So let's talk about the city. What is it about the cityscape and about cities in general that make them critically important geographical spaces for us to pay close attention to in terms of representation?
Well, firstly, cities, the global phenomena. Most people or most countries are urbanizing quite rapidly. It's not a South African thing. In fact, we are urbanizing slower than other countries in the world, like India and China. South Africa has, I think, 64% of our population are urbanized. So, well, our media there, opportunities are there, culture and interconnectedness and opportunity to learn from each other happens at cities at a faster rate than anywhere else. So it is at this point that we need to make large differences and create knowledgeable societies. And we can do that while focusing on cities.
Tease out for me what happens to us psychosocially or politically when cities do not manage to achieve more inclusive forms of representation and memorialization of history that actually speaks accurately to who we are and where we come from. What does that do to the inhabitants of the city?
Well, a number of things. Firstly, a group of people don't feel included in the city. They don't, and I truly believe this, that the protest, firstly, and secondly, the violent protest, which, by the way, has increased in our democracy, which is surprising. So violent protest has increased in South African cities. We are known to be the protest capital of the world, and violent protest has increased in South African cities. And I truly believe that one of the reasons, in addition to service delivery, that this is about being seen and being heard in our cities. So in Cape Town, for instance, just over 84% of Cape Town's population is brown. So mixed race, black, and has Indian ancestry. And yet that is not visible in the city. If you think that 47% of the population is so-called colored or mixed race, that history and identity does not manifest itself visibly in the physical landscape of the city, except for certain parts of the city that are exotified for tourism narratives. Mm. So you see people protesting against this. They want to be seen. They want to be heard. They want their histories and their presence to be known in the current and contemporary discourse of the city. What it also does to the psyche of a person who wishes to contribute to a city, if they don't see their histories, if they don't know what their histories are, then they don't understand that their history, that their ancestors were responsible for the making of the city. So if you walk around Cape Town, what is very visible is through architecture is Cape Dutch architecture, but also colonial memorials and monuments by way of statues. So if you walk through the city as a person who has European ancestry, you can see yourself in the making of the city. The stories are told quite prominently, but people of other ancestries, their stories are not told in the city. And so in our democracy, we have failed in telling these stories. And I think in 1994, the city had a wonderful opportunity to claim its, for the purpose of this discussion, I'm going to call Creole identity, because I feel very uncomfortable with the word colored that was given through colonial terms and then manifested again through apartheid. We have not in 1994 asserted our Creole identity. And instead of calling ourselves this rainbow nation, we should have, you know, blended the colors of the rainbow and made this brown city that it is, considering that it is a brown city. If we are
In that regard, one of the things that I've learned from you the last time you and I had dinner was, even in relation to the history of language, quite apart from the representation in terms of things like statues, that Afrikaans itself has got an interesting history in terms of Dutch Creole languages. And that's something that I didn't know, because even the place of slaves are often rendered invisible in the telling of their history.
Absolutely. So everything about Cape Town is Creole, and whether we care to admit it or not. So this project that I'm doing currently, I've called it C, largely because I want people to have a look closer to their cities, but also Sea, which is the Afrikaans word for ocean. We're focusing on the maritime history of the Cape and the movements of people from Indonesia, India, different parts of Africa and Europe to the Cape to make this Creole condition. And so Afrikaans is a Dutch Creole language, which contains African languages, Arabic, Indian languages, Indonesian languages in this language. It was only later with the development of Afrikaner nationalism that these words were taken out, or mainly taken out of the language, of the Afrikaans language, and then the Die Severtaal was created. But the roots, so even the first texts in Afrikaans were in Arabic. I visited the Taal Monument a few times, but this time I went to the Taal Museum. And what I find problematic is that a lot of this history is not included even in the museum. And they don't also include the violence that happened at that time that this language was divided. And I think it is important to speak the truth. I don't feel like it helps anyone to create any fluff around very important narratives of the past.
What's in a name?
What's in a name? So, yes, I'm working with an incredible group of people in Holland where we discuss exactly this. People called Inuit people Eskimos, for instance. We're calling a very complex and interesting group of people, which in South Africa, we call them colored. In Brazil, there's a whole range of words that describe people of mixed ancestry. What I also learned while researching for this project is that most people think that Indian history in South Africa started with British imperialism in KwaZulu-Natal. But it was the Dutch that brought Indian people to the Cape as enslaved people. And a quarter of the enslaved people were Indian. And a quarter from Indonesia, a quarter from Madagascar, and the rest from other parts of Africa. Those group of people at that time outnumbered white settler people in the Cape. And so also dissecting this so-called colored and Afrikaner, if we go back in time, I followed three Cape ancestors. Simon van der Stel, for instance, everyone regards him.
I was coming to Simon van der Stel because you want to set the cat among some Afrikaner pigeons. I was like, really? I almost dropped my starters when you told me that actually this dude, infamously from my Standard 3 textbook, was Creole.
But on the outset, I just want to say, before I get onto the Cape ancestors, is that I'm not trying to attack by this work by any means, Africa or people that identify themselves as Afrikaner. If anything, what I want to dispel is this racial purity, whether it is completely black or completely white. It's a toxic dead end if we focus on this. My point with this project is firstly to focus on the history and how we remember that history, and then ultimately how do we create a more resilient, inclusive city and places generally in South Africa.
And so it sounds to me, as I hear, if I step back from some of the wonderful texture and detail you've given us so far, that when it comes to public memory and our collective history as South Africans, and we take, say, Cape Town as one example of a city in terms of physical representation, questions of language, questions of memory, that quite literally things are not black and white, and that we haven't paid proper historical attention to the reality that there are details here about who inhabited the city, who resisted, what exactly the genealogy is, even of people that have been seen as white colonial figures, for example, and that it gets all messy. And in fact, our roots are intertwined in ways that may be uncomfortable for all of us.
Absolutely. And that's exactly which that we, in part I want to focus on with this project of ours. That firstly, in that discomfort, we need to look at each other differently and also look at our cities differently. That they're made up of, and this is why all the books that we publish are anthologies, because the point that we make with this work is that cities are made up of different people, all sorts of people. And so in writing the city and in making the city, we all have a contribution to make. And because during, well, colonialism, as you know, but especially through apartheid more recently, the Afrikaner nationalist agenda was strong. And so their narratives their version of the narratives were strongly highlighted. Sure. And so with this project, we merely, instead of saying, you know, many people assume that there's just one pie and the pie has a certain size. But what we're saying is that we're widening that scope of history. We're widening our understanding of it. So we're not taking away from anyone's narrative, but rather adding to it. And then also making visible other stories that may come up, whether that it is sense, about the San people, the Khoi and other First Nations people, the movements of the Nguni. I often hear from my Afrikaner friends that would say to me, oh, but you know, black people were not the first people in the Cape or in South Africa. And so if we start to divide in this way and in semantics, then it doesn't serve anybody. But what That's we need to do is, because we, you know, we can't see history in bits of time. We have to see it as a movement of time and also parallel to each other. So we are all mixtures of some sort. And so going back to Simon van der Stel and the two other ancestors, just for this call, otherwise we can have a very long discussion about all the ancestors. But for this particular, the reason that I mentioned these three is because they were highlighted in history and they had some sort of power. Simon van der Stel, huge amount of power, with Stellenbosch named after him. His grandmother was an enslaved woman from Goa. And so so would he be classified as colored, Cape Malay, or Afrikaner? Then there was Angela van Bengal. She was also an enslaved person that was owned by Jan van Riebeeck and then later sold on. And then she was freed by one of her enslavers, and Arnoldus Basson, who married her. And they had children together, and she's the matriarch of the entire Basson family in South Africa. And so would she also be classified, or her children, I assume the Basson surname, they're classified as Afrikaner. She went on, when her husband passed away, she went on to own parts of which was then called Herengracht Street, which is now Adderley Street. She doubled the wealth she inherited and became the first woman landowner in the Cape. And then her daughter, Anna de Kooning, owned Groot Constantia. And so is all of this in the public memory? And why I mention these three, you know, most people will be like, oh, it's in the past. It just makes for a nice fairy tale. No, it doesn't. It's important because they were enslaved people. Their children were either of three, as classified in today's time, Cape Malay, colored, or Afrikaner. But as you know, the Afrikaner story was a very privileged one. A Cape Malay or colored story is not. It's a disadvantaged one. And also, there's a lot of shame and confusion and erasure of memory in that part of our society. So to us to reflect on these ancestors and go, oh, wow, so they were actually colored too. And what does it say? So we are not aiming to write the entire history. I don't aim to be a historian at the end of this project, but rather for each of us in Cape Town and other parts of the world to go, oh, what is my ancestry? And I'm not just a descendant of a slave. And also, let's go back to what a slaved person was, an enslaved person was. No one chose to be enslaved. People were enslaved. And so we have to give power to these people that were lost in our society. And so a large group of so-called colored people in the Cape, or generally, you know, I often hear this, that they feel lost and they don't know their history. And I often hear some black people tell me, oh, well, you know, coloreds don't know who they are. And here's a wonderful opportunity for all of us to find out who we are.
Absolutely. 24 minutes after 11 o'clock, we're in conversation with Zahira Ashmal, founder and managing director of The City. And so much that I'm learning just listening to her. That's why I said to you earlier, you will love her. You'll be enthralled. And these are not just stories for the sake of storytelling. This matters fundamentally. It shapes our understanding of who we are, where we come from, and it impacts us even at a psychosocial and political identity level, because we have to reckon with our past. Here are my questions to you. Do you know your own ancestry? When it comes to iconography, such as statues, such as buildings and architecture, whether you're in Cape Town, whether you are somewhere in the Karoo, whether you're in Uitenhage and Ooskaap, how do you experience the architecture of the city in which you live? Do you feel that it speaks to you and to your community? Or do you feel excluded when you're finding yourself in De Waterkant, for example, and hanging out on a Sunday afternoon, in terms of specifically the physical architecture of the city that you are living in? 011-883-0702, what are your reflections, your experiences? Cape Town, 021-446-0567.
Adding to my knowledge as well.
But she makes an important additional point. Why is it, and you've touched on it already, that many of us are obsessed about racial purity in our ancestry? We are scared to be, you know, for a country that's deeply divided, isn't it ironic that we are scared at the possibility of being intimately related?
Do you know what I think it is? I think it's a few things that are in the past and in the current condition. In the past, it has to do with identifying with a place. So people can say, I'm from there. Once you are mixed, then it brings in a situation of confusion. And I remember being a child, and my mom is Iranian, my dad is South African of Indian ancestry, and my mom's also part Burmese. And I remember when I was a child, I mean, you remember these forms we had to fill out at school, and I always ticked other if it was available. And And I remember our teachers being quite upset about this. And they said, well, don't you know who you are? But in our family, we embraced the mixtures. So, of course, I knew who I was, who I am. But I think in the current condition, it's our racial politics.
Yeah.
Because I have to ask, if we are a democracy, we all say we are in a democracy. We're certainly not acting like one. And we're not looking like one. And what are the active steps that our government is making in that direction? And why is this, and especially in Cape Town, we are not making any steps to actively engage with this Creole condition that we are, which is very exciting, by the way, and which also makes us unique in many ways. When you have a hyper white and a hyper black, you allow for political polarization. And
that's
you see
so beautifully put. Very beautiful. Let's just hold on to that thought.
702 at Cape Talk.
27 minutes before noon. Now, one of the moments talking about recent politics, Zahira, in recent years that caught the attention of the public was obviously with the Fallist Generation and the Roads Must Fall movement in relation to very specific memorials and statues around Cape Town, including on UCT campus. What are your reflections in terms of that? Because you made a point earlier that when it comes to correcting public memory that is ahistorical, that we're not trying to get rid of stuff, but we are trying to render visible that which has been deliberately excluded for all sorts of colonial and apartheid ideological reasons. And when you look at a statue falling like, say, Cecil John Rhodes' statue, what comes up for you?
Wow, I think Rhodes Must Fall was a very powerful moment in Cape Town, but also South Africa's history and current condition. I think it created a wonderful opportunity for debate, discourse on our cities and public space and how we move through that space. And it has informed a lot of my work currently. I think for me, at the moment that it was happening, I was actually with Wandile on the eve of the Rhodes Must Fall, before Tsumani threw a bucket of feces on Cecil John Rhodes. I was with Wandile and we were in Johannesburg. I was participating in an event there. And he said to me, my friend's going to do it. He's going to throw shit on Rhodes. And I said, I'm assuming a statue of Rhodes. And so I started to investigate this because I said, well, why does he have to throw shit on Rhodes? Can't there be another way? And I found an excerpt in the 1967 UCT Varsity newspaper where Cecil John Rhodes himself said that he would build UCT out of the Kaffir's stomach. So I thought it was quite fitting that the movement's founder, Tsumani, threw a bucket of feces at Cecil John Rhodes. Mm. I mean, of course, his reasoning was different at the time. It was about showing the conditions that people in the townships lived with every day. Mm. And so when people said to me, and I mean, this was LB Sachs as well. You'll remember he wrote an article soon after saying that we shouldn't tear down things. We should reframe them and maybe tease these colonial masters. And I have to say, on this point, I am completely with the Rhodes Must Fall founders, where they say that public space, the public realm should be celebrating a common democracy, not a privileged one. And so when we have in public space...
But what about the destruction of the statue? Because there are very different readings between destroying a statue and throwing excrement or feces at a statue. The one I can write a more easy 2,000 worth quote-unquote think piece about. The destruction one has got a very different kind of logic. Do you support either of those kinds of interaction with exclusionary iconography?
That's a good point you're raising. I think the excrement element was to raise an awareness of how Black people are living in our democracy in South Africa. So I think that was a strong point made by the founders. But also the destruction or tearing down of statues, I support that. I feel the response from a lot of white people in South Africa about tearing down our statues and removing our history is to say that they identify with British imperialism, with apartheid. And so I have to question those people that say our history, because the history happened to everybody, not just white people or Black people. Hmm. That time or whatever happened in that time happened to most people. And I also just want to make reference to what many people say when protesting, you know, against Zuma and others, when they say, they quote something that Mandela had said, if the ANC government has done to you or does to you what the National Party or party government has done to you, you should treat them the same way. And then but who's the to you? Because apartheid treated white people very differently to how they treated people of color.
Yes.
And so although we are on the other side of history, history happened to all of us. And so I also receive a lot of calls from my Afrikaner friends when Rhodes was falling that, how can they destroy our history? And so I raise again, do you identify with British imperial history? And it was also, if you go back in time, in 1956, Since the Nationalists came into power in 1948,
yeah.
That group of people had been protesting to have that very statue to come down from 1948 to 1956, mm-hmm. and they were unsuccessful. UCT pulled that statue from the highway to its grounds.
Mm.
And so what does that say? What it says as well currently is that Afrikaner people identify more with being white rather than that British imperialism that that time was ruining South Africa.
So there's a kind of post-democratic retreat into a racialized lager,
yes, exactly.
Despite the fact that there were these interesting linguistic fissures before black people
Absolutely.
Had political equality.
Absolutely. And so we should rather be finding unity in our democracy rather than the whiteness or the racial. So this is what I think. And also Tumani made a good point when I hosted them at the Franschhoek Literary Festival on my panel on the movement of objects, where I analyzed the lack of movement of these objects, of these colonial objects that dot our cityscape in Cape Town and other cities in South Africa. And in there, an audience member asked Tumani that, okay, well, the same story, our statues, our university. He says, why don't you just like create another university than destroying the one at UCT? And Tumani's response was that it all belongs to us. It doesn't. It's not a white university. It may have been that during apartheid, and so there's a very deep division on the way people, especially white people, understand South Africa and history compared to how it happened and how people of color understand history.
So where does this leave us overall? Because the one thing that you are very clear about in your work is that different people remember history differently, and we do so through the prism of our own lived experiences, and of course the different hegemonies within which we may or may not find ourselves from the point of view of identitarian politics. And and if we are aiming at an inclusive series of cultural iconography and a more inclusive and complete public memory, then getting rid of a statue of, say, someone like Cecil John Rhodes, isn't that unremembering as opposed to adding the histories of the enslaved people, the Creole history, making the circle bigger discursively and in terms of representation without necessarily getting rid of the Cecil John Rhodes statue?
So I think it goes to what we value in our democracy. Because right now it isn't clear to me what the South African government values. And in Cape Town's case, it is not clear at all. For instance, the government continuously tells us that there's no money to tear down statues and create other public discourses culturally, heritage. But there's still a line item in the city of Cape Town's budget that maintains these structures. So there is money going towards these elements. So I think we should look deeply into what we value in our democracy. If our democracy says that we need to celebrate a democratic presence, then we need to focus on the Creole history and memory. We need to understand what the core history is, the San history, and we need to celebrate that in public space.
For sure.
We cannot have a colonial. I mean, just going to Germany very quickly, I was just there a month ago, and there isn't a single. So to respond to a lot of white people that say, oh, but our history is being destroyed. You cannot destroy history. That's not possible. It has happened already. It's how we remember that history.
Yeah.
So, for instance, you go anywhere in Germany, there isn't a single statue of Hitler and any of those Nazi party leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Yet everybody in the world knows Adolf Hitler. They know what he did, the dates that it happened, and what he was responsible for. It is in our collective public memory globally. So we do not need statues to remember the past. And also people remember the past differently, as you said. Some people have statues, ceremony, music, and other ways.
That's
so
right.
Why don't we ask our leaders that are in the Khoi sector, in the Khoi communities and San communities, go deeper into these spaces and understand how they wish the history to be remembered. And we bring those narratives onto the fore. And I mean, I meet so many white South Africans that don't know what happened on June 16th, 21st March, 27th April. Why?
Wow.
Because we do not value the stories from the past, we only value some of them. And so what happens is most white people only know Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu. And then there's
the Nelson Mandela that they want to remember.
The statesman and the peacekeeper, rather than, I mean, what he fought for, what young black people are fighting for today are the very things that Nelson Mandela fought for in the past. So we need to remember him, even just as a figure, in a more holistic way.
A final question. A couple of my listeners are listening to what you are saying and mindful of the gaps of their own understanding about iconography, the cityscape, what is in our museums, interesting men and women that have been airbrushed out of history. For the average Joe, whose interest is piqued to try and understand better what it means to live, say, for example, in Cape Town, if there isn't public memory that is easily memorialized, books that are available, how does one begin to fill in gaps in your own knowledge of the city that you live in?
I think just extending to what I said about valuing, like I mean, my family asked me how to make friends with black people. And I was really taken aback by this kind of question. In a country where 70% of the population is black, you shouldn't have trouble making black friends. But it goes back to what you value. And in that question, they have just told me that they do not value it.
Yeah.
And so I think the first step is to step outside your very immediate realm and community and meet people. Do you know, I also went to the ICA, the Institute for Creative Arts, that Jay Pather heads, is incredible. I mean, they do incredible work. And they had a series of talks on the TRC, which I've attended. And in the room, they're mainly people of color. And the only white people in the room were above 80 upwards, and international students from Denmark and the Netherlands. And that says a lot. And there was a young black student that raised this. He said, well, where are the young white people? Do they not care about the future of South Africa? Why aren't they learning about the TRC and how we can move together? And that's very true. And then secondly, I think people should reach out to the projects that we are working on. I have to tell you, this project that we're doing, C, is not, I mean, the themes are not new. It's post-colonial studies all over the world. Mm. However, it's... what I have to question as well with government as well as academia, I mean, a lot of the work, I've only started this project last year, so all of this is new for me as well, or some of it is new. I've learned so much, and all of this is in the archive. It is in the history books. It is at the University of Cape Town and UWC. Yep. Mm. Why is it not in the public realm? Mm. And that goes back to the politics. And like, why isn't our government sharing this information publicly? Why aren't there documentaries being made? I mean, absolutely. There are a lot of documentaries on the Holocaust. In fact, when I was in Munich recently, a new documentation center just opened. I mean, this was 60 years after World War II, a new documentation just got opened. So why isn't there an interest in South Africa? I ask this question every day.
Let's end it there. Absolutely stunning. Huge response from the listeners. We'll podcast it. If you want to follow more of Zahira's work, go check out thecityagency.co.za. Let's just take one quick call here from one of our listeners, Zahira. Mikhail, hello.
Hi, UCBS, and hi, Zahira.
Hello.
Hi. We've actually met once before, very briefly, but I just really want to comment and thank you for the things that you've been saying. I just caught the end of this conversation in the car, and I just... I'm a white South African, and I've been trying to articulate the kinds of things that you and Eusebius are articulating in the kinds of conversations that we always have. And you've just put it so in such important terms. And I really just, I'm very grateful for that. And I wish more white South Africans could learn to speak like you are, because we're the ones who have to kind of acknowledge those histories and bring them into the discourse. So, thank you for giving us words that we need to now learn to speak ourselves.
Thank you, Mikhail. And Zahira, thank you so much. Stunning work. Thanks for your passion and also for the nature of these projects as well. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me and having me.